This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined by Bradley Chambers. This week, the show has two sponsors for the first time. We're sponsored by EasyGrade, an iPhone app for teachers that replaces the cardboard EasyGrader. And now a new sponsor, BDoc's Timeline 3D for iOS, which lets teachers and students create and present timelines on iPad, iPhone, and iPod Touch. How are you doing this week, Bradley?
Doing fantastic. Thankfully, Chattanooga is hundreds of miles away from the hurricane, so it's just very cold here.
Okay, good. Well, I'm glad you survived it. We actually did intend to have a different show this week with a secret special guest. We were going to talk Evernote, but our guest has been indisposed by the hurricane, so we'll reschedule that once they're all back on their feet there, and we hope that doesn't take too long for them. Great show last week, by the way. Nice to be back, but well done.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Andrew's very, very, very smart. And so we really had a lot of fun. He's a great person to follow on Twitter, especially if you're into wireless. He's always talking about kind of what's coming and pitfalls and things like that. So his Twitter handle is in the show notes from last week.
Yeah, I certainly learned a couple of things as well. I was not clear at all on the implications of 802.11ac for deployments, high density deployments like ours. So that was good info for me. And I also say you opened the show with asking how to pronounce his name. For those of you who didn't listen to the last show, his name is Von Nagy, N-A-G-Y. And a piece of ancient trivia history is that when I was a boy, my dad used to take me to speedway racing in Glasgow, dirt bike racing. And riding for the Glasgow Tigers in the early 90s, there was a Hungarian rider called Robert Nagy, whose name was spelled the same way, N-A-G-Y. So that was my small claim to international competence, was to know how to pronounce a certain Hungarian surname based on the exploits of a speedway rider in the 90s in Glasgow. So, yeah, great show, and hope to have some more guests on as time goes by.
Yeah, I think it's always fun to get some outside perspective, especially people from different schools, because different schools do things differently. And so it's always good to get a different perspective.
Absolutely. So it was a busy week in the world of Apple education and all of that kind of stuff. We've got quite a lot to talk about today. First thing I guess we'll go into is last week's Apple event, which turned out to be quite a big one. You know, a lot of people thought that Apple was just squeezing in one more event before the Christmas break. I don't know what you were expecting, Bradley, but I certainly got more than I bargained for in terms of the amount of things that were updated and released at that event.
Yeah, I really was surprised. The thing I'm most perplexed about is the iMac release date. And, you know, since it's not, I don't even think you can order it until November.
No, I don't think you can.
I don't understand. Why not wait and announce that in January and let your supply build up?
Yeah, that was an interesting one. I wasn't totally sure. I mean, I know that I watched it with a number of other people because we streamed it on our Apple TV. And of all the things that they announced, actually, the one that got the biggest sort of collective gasp was the iMac, in terms of just how incredibly thin that display has become. So it's certainly a very impressive product, I thought. What do you think of Fusion Drive?
Well, I think it's a great stopgap because there seems to be this ever-growing problem, you know, especially in the laptop world, where we want the speed of the SSDs, but we want the big hard drive size, and we really are starting to see that in desktops as well. You know, we want the robustness of the flash memory and the solid state drives, but we just want the capacity. I actually have a 1 terabyte drive in my laptop, and I use half of that. You know, obviously a lot of that things is music and movies that could be purged, but I've got a couple of VMware images that are 30, 40 gigabytes a piece. And so a 128 drive for me really just isn't going to cut it. And so I think we're a few years away. You know, John Siracusa on the latest Hypercritical talked about how, you know, as the SSD and flash memory capacity is going up and the cost is going down, but at the same time, traditional spinning disk drives are getting cheaper and the capacity is going up. You know, they're not stopping as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it sort of struck me when they said, oh, you can get... Well, just to be clear for those who aren't sure what a Fusion Drive is, it's basically an SSD and a hard drive glued together in software such that the most popular and busiest files automatically migrate onto the faster SSD and the lesser used files migrate onto the slower hard drive. But it was when they paired together the SSD and a 3 terabyte hard drive. It's like, wow, because I had sort of forgotten to think about how big hard drives were getting, you know. Been so sort of focused on when can I get a bigger SSD, you know. So I think Fusion Drive is interesting. I am not sure I want to be the first customer to buy one, let's put it that way. But we'll see how that goes.
Now, is it an SSD drive or is it an actual flash memory stick?
I'm not certain. Obviously, we haven't seen any teardowns of these desktops yet. But I think it could potentially be either. I suspect probably for space savings, it'll be something a little more welded into the case than just a very straightforward SATA-based SSD.
Well, the one time I've taken apart a MacBook Air completely, when you pull out that flash memory stick, it really feels like it's just a little larger than a stick of RAM. And so, I agree with you. I don't know that I want to be the first generation of customers using that, but it does seem to be a great compromise. I think it's a situation where Apple's integration of hardware and software is paying off because they can do things like this. They can spend the money on research and development on something like this and then make it work at the OS level. So can't wait to see the teardowns of these. And I'm also interested in looking at the repair manuals for the new iMac and for the new Mac Mini as well to see some of the notes on the Fusion drives. I kind of made the joke to a buddy of mine that the repair manual for the iMac will be a one-page PDF with a link to the Apple Store to buy a new one.
Abandon hope, all ye who enter here.
Yeah. Because if you start to look at these repair manuals for some of these newer models, they're not getting harder to work on. They're just getting more expensive. And so the MacBook Air is not hard to work on from a hardware perspective, but there are just fewer parts to work on. You're getting, they have these things in repair manuals called deep dives. It's try this, if this result, try this result, try this. Those are getting shorter and it's replace the logic board. It's you're ending it with replace the logic board more often, which, And I look at the cost on those and we buy parts at wholesale from Apple through our self-servicing agreement. But I forget that a lot of people have to take their Mac to the Apple store, their Apple reseller. They don't pay wholesale costs on the parts and then they pay labor. And so, we pay, the average logic board may be $350 for me to buy. But if you go try to buy that at a Mac store, it may cost you $550 plus two, three hours of labor.
Yeah.
And so, the idea, I think, of this integration is that you'll have fewer problems. But when you do have problems, it's kind of like iOS, where if your iPad doesn't turn on, there's not a lot you can do.
Yeah, I mean, I have a memory of this is turning into reminiscence evening for Fraser. But when I was a kid, my father being absolutely furious that the headlights in his car had been turned into sealed units, where you couldn't replace the glass separately from the reflector in the back, and he was just outraged that you were going to have to replace the whole thing if you chipped or cracked the glass on the headlight screen, and I guess what happened is they just started making better headlights so they didn't crack. And I can't remember the last person I knew that had a cracked headlight in their car that didn't crash it. So it just seems the way the world's going. What else did we have? We had 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro, which is interesting because, I don't know if you've seen a 15-inch MacBook Pro in person with a Retina display, but it is... Unless you have £2,000 in your pocket when you go and look at that computer, you should probably not go and look at that computer because nothing else will do after you see one of those things. The display is incredible. The design of the machine is just quite fantastic. And I thought it was interesting that they brought it to a 13-inch size and that they didn't bring it to the 13-inch MacBook Air. And my guess for this is that the MacBook Air is obviously taper to a point at the front, whereas the Retina display MacBook Pros do not taper, they're flat, and I guess that extra volume gives you enough extra battery to run a Retina display. Because it seems to me that what Apple needs right now is they need a power consumption breakthrough for Retina displays. That it's not necessarily actually all about the cost of that display as much as the cost of powering it with battery. That seems to be the most difficult thing for a Retina display right now. So, looks like a nice machine. I would love to have one, but I'm still holding off for a Retina MacBook Air.
Well, I actually saw a 13-inch Retina today. I was at a Best Buy buying a couple of monitors, which if you follow me on Twitter, you know it took me at least an hour and a half to buy three monitors because it apparently is difficult to process tax-exempt at Best Buy. So that was a lot of fun. But I did get to see one. Very nice machine. And I try to look at things like, what do I want personally and what would I deploy school-wide? And for me, I would love one personally. Like I think I could probably, if I had the money and I was ready to buy a new machine today, I would probably go with a 13-inch Retina. Because I don't want to spend money on something at this point that's non-Retina for me personally. But if I'm looking at deploying something to our teachers, which I am, it just doesn't, when you start adding that cost to, 20 to 30 machines, that really adds up quickly.
It does.
And so, it's just hard. It's just, I don't think that device is certainly aimed at the education yet. Now, I think this reminds me of where the Air was when it first released. It was more of this is a trophy product almost.
Yeah. It's aspirational. It's the BMW of the Apple lineup, I guess. And I think, I don't know what you think, but I sort of have a feeling that the thing that we geeks don't want to admit to ourselves is that there's a large proportion of the world that can't actually discern the difference between a Retina display and a regular display. I've had this conversation several times now where I've given people my iPad 3 and they've gone, well, it's just the same as the iPad 2. I'm like, are you crazy? It's look at it. It's completely different. And people who have not spent time with Retina displays don't always appreciate their benefit. So I think it's a little difficult to argue for, a $500 premium on a laptop, primarily for a Retina display, particularly to people who haven't gotten used to Retina displays. Now, if you have, like you and I have got used to Retina displays, then you're ruined forever. And that's the end of it. You can never have anything. Nothing else will really satisfy. But it's not the Retina value proposition, I think, is not absolutely clear to everybody yet. And I'm not honestly sure that it ever will be. I think there will always be people who would prefer cheaper, lighter, less battery-hungry devices as a trade-off for Retina.
Well, and I think, a good analogy would be look at high-definition television. I still talk to people that will buy a high-definition television but will not get high-definition service. And I ask them why, and I say, look, look at mine. Look at my football games. Look how much better it is. And they kind of shrug their shoulders. Yeah, it's better, but I don't want to pay for it. It's not that much better. And my wife, she's got an iPad 2, and I've got that junky old iPad 3 that it's just obsolete. I'm surprised it still even works. But and I show her the difference, and she doesn't care. I mean, her iPad works, and I think we're getting to that place with the iPad specifically, where they're so powerful at this point, especially starting with the iPad 2. It was so much more powerful than the 1 that regular people just don't care. If I ask my wife, hey, we have $500 to spend, would you like an iPad 2 or an iPad 4? She would, no, I'm fine. She has no interest in an iPad 4. She said her 2's fine. And I can show her the difference between my iPad and hers, and, she's not that impressed. And my boss is the same way. He has an iPad 3 and can't really tell the difference.
Yep. I think it's interesting, and I think possibly for that reason, that's part of the reason why the iPad 2 still exists, is because there's enough of a constituency of people who just would rather it was $100 cheaper than any technological advancement with displays. Now, you mentioned the junk and obsolete iPad 3 that you and I are both using right now. We have been gazumped, if you like. We have been superseded by the fourth generation iPad, which is, as far as I can tell, it's basically an iPhone 5 in an iPad's body in terms of the internals. Lightning connector, physically otherwise basically the same, with an A6X processor. Now, X in the Apple terminology seems to basically mean enough graphics horsepower to run an iPad-sized Retina display. So the iPhone 5 has an A6 processor. The fourth generation iPad has an A6X processor, but they're roughly hitting the same benchmarks in there. So it's basically that they've had the iPad catch up with the iPhone 5, as far as I can tell. Is that your take on the thing as well?
Yeah. It sounds like it sounds like a great upgrade. And if I had an iPad 2, this would seal the deal. I would probably want one right away.
Yeah.
But my iPad 3, it still works great. I have not noticed anything slowing down. And there's enough iPad 2s on the market that outside of your kind of premium game designers, people aren't going to start, developing specifically for the fourth generation iPad. And yeah. I guess what I would want mostly out of an iPad 4 would be the Lightning connector, because now I could totally ditch the 30-pin connectors because my wife and I both have iPhone 5s. Mm-hmm. I guess this is what they call first world problems.
Yes, it's probably the first of first world problems. But I think, I wrote in my blog just after the event, I said, there's one thing that I never want is Apple to slow down the rate at which iPads get better, because, we're going to be refreshing our devices in school next year. Now we've got an opportunity to get something that is basically double the speed. Because if you look at the benchmarks, if you look at Geekbench, for example, I was actually doing this in school with a class about a month or so ago. We were looking at the Geekbench scores for various generations of iPad and iPhone and so on. And the iPhone 5 hits 1,500 Geekbench points, which, if you look back at the history of the Mac, that's the same score as the 2004 Mac Pro, or Power Mac G5 as it was then, actually. It scored about 1,500 Geekbench points, and so does the iPhone 5, which is over the course of 9 years, that amount of computing power goes from a desktop tower machine with a liquid cooling system inside it to something the size of an iPhone 5, which is an incredible sort of very visual representation of Moore's Law and what it actually means for you. And to take that power and put it in an iPad as well is pretty cool. And I'm glad to see them catch up, because one of the things that was noticeable when we did that exercise was that every generation was a step in Geekbench points, except for the iPad 3. The iPad 3 essentially hit about 700 Geekbench points. And that wasn't a massive jump over the iPad 2. A little bit, but not a huge amount. Because they went from A5 to A5X with the iPad 3. And that was all in service of the Retina display. And it's really only now with the iPad, fourth generation iPad, that we've seen a large step in actual processing performance in the iPad since the iPad 2. And it's interesting, you mentioned there that it's unlikely that people will start targeting the A6 chip exclusively soon. And of course, one of the reasons for that is there's a ton of A5 class devices out there in the world, all the iPad 2s. A5X processor isn't actually that much faster than the A5. So all, basically, of the 100 million iPads that are out there, what is it, maybe 86 million of them are A5 processors, because there's about 14 million A4-based iPad 1s in the world. So there's just such a massive installed base of A5 that people expect to work. So A5 architecture is pretty sound for a while. And of course, the last thing that Apple announced at that event, the iPad Mini, further extends the life of the A5 architecture, because the iPad Mini is basically an iPad 2 in a tiny body. And I am personally very excited about the iPad Mini. I wasn't sure that I was going to be. I'm not sure that I will be after I get one either, but I'm sitting here 2 days away from delivery on my iPad Mini, so I'm still in that kind of excited mode about it at the moment. What was your take on the Mini?
Well, I really want to get one in hand, and I want to play with it. I want to see how the touch targets work. I want to see how the typing works on it. You know, I mentioned multiple times on the show that we're negotiating with Apple right now on our lease, and I kind of redid what I wanted. And we're going to look at doing quite a few iPad minis. And from what I can tell right now, you know, Apple with iOS devices, if you buy in packs of 10, they will give you a little bit of a break. And so kind of their standard pricing in the U.S. is if you buy 10 iPad minis, you can get them at $309 instead of $329. So you're really driving the cost down of an iOS device. So I'm going to wait and see. I'm going to hear your thoughts and hear some other educators' thoughts. And I'll probably get my hands on one at some point this fall and play with one, maybe spend a couple of days with it. Because I would love to, if it can do what I want it to do in the classroom, all it does is save me money and allows me to buy more.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting because before the event, I sort of posited the question that, does Apple believe that people want a smaller iPad, or does Apple believe that people want a cheaper iPad? And what you do if you believe one or other of those things is very different. And I think it's very clear that what they've decided is that people actively want a physically smaller iPad. And I think it's fascinating to look at the iPad mini and see just how much of an iPad it actually is. Because it's got, you know, you think of all the things that they could have dropped out to get the thing cheaper. It's got a apparently good front and back camera. It's got, I think it's got the 720p front camera, actually.
Yes.
It's got, they started at 16 gigabytes. There was rumors that they might start to 8 gigabytes to cut the price, but they didn't do that. And I think we've spoken before about why that wouldn't be a good idea in terms of the size of books and the size of applications and so on. It runs full iOS. There's no functional software differences between an iPad 2 and an iPad mini in terms of what it can do. So literally every task that you do on your full-size iPad can go onto the iPad mini. And I think that's important as well. You're really getting the full power of the ecosystem and all the applications to come along with it. It still supports AirPlay, which is important. There's a 3G option, 4G option if you're lucky to live in America and not in the UK. And so on and so on. And I think the line that they're using for it in advertising is every inch an iPad. And I think that's, you know, quite often people look for kind of criminology in these Apple titles. But I think that is exactly, that's what quite often you hear after the fact, that these marketing phrases as they appear are actually kind of guiding statements for the development of the product. So if you remember the original iPad, the phrase was a magical and revolutionary product at an unbelievable price. And that was kind of the phrase that guided the thinking behind the device. And I think the iPad mini is very much the same, that you are getting a full iPad experience, but smaller. And yeah, you're paying for it, you know. And that was obviously the big controversy point, was that when they announced $329 in the US or £269 in the UK, people sort of instinctively reacted and said that that was just way too expensive. And I initially agreed with that as well. I thought, yeah, that's not the pricing I'd been hoping for. But, you know, on reflection, the price I'd been hoping for was a bit stupid. You know, it was, I think what I wanted to do was I was kind of psyching myself up for Apple to kind of do a finishing move on everybody else. You know, they were just going to come out and they were going to just chop everything to bits and they would all just go home crying the next day, you know. Which is obviously not Apple's game. But I think what has happened with the iPad pricing is that the only way you can undercut Apple now is to basically forgo profit on the device. Because we know that the Nexus 7 is being sold essentially at cost, and that the Kindle Fire, that is Amazon's explicit strategy, is that they're essentially selling those devices at cost as well. So it'll be interesting to see the effects of the iPad mini on the market in the long run. I don't think there will be any effect in the short term, except to kind of galvanize the people who are trying to sell them at cheaper prices and try and make out that, you saw Amazon this week, make out that Apple are basically charging you more for less than you would get with a Kindle Fire. So we will see how it goes. I think we're going to talk a little more next week about iPad Mini. I'll actually have mine by then, so we'll not spend too much more time on it just now, I don't think. But we'll talk about it once I've got one in hand as well and see what it's like. Just one thing to mention about in hand, I actually made a paper prototype of the iPad Mini. There's a link in the show notes to Apple provide blueprints and measurements for people who want to make cases for phones and iPads and iPod Touches and so on. And what I did was I just got a piece of paper and I drew out to scale the physical size of the iPad Mini and also the screen dimension and where that fits inside the overall size of the device. And it's actually a very instructional little exercise, particularly if you're not going to buy an iPad Mini straight away. But you can actually work out the height of the keyboard in both orientations as well. Because one of my biggest concerns and one of my biggest complaints about the Nexus 7 and tablets like it that use a 16 by 10 aspect ratio in their screen is that when you put it in landscape and you bring the keyboard up, because the keyboard has to be sized for the size of human hands, when you bring the keyboard up on a Nexus 7, you've basically got 3 to 4 lines of text at the top of the screen of your content, and the rest of the entire device is the keyboard. And just sketching it out on my little paper prototype of the Mini, it looks like you will have a lot more actual usable screen space, even when the keyboard is up on this device, than you have on a Nexus 7. So I think that 4:3 aspect ratio, excuse me, could actually be all the difference in terms of usability on these devices.
Well, and especially in our settings. I mean, I'm of the opinion that if you need a keyboard full time for your tablet, then I just don't think that we need that. I mean, I think there, if you're writing a big paper, that's one thing, but I think kids should be able to type on the touchscreen to take notes in their history class. If, you know, I could do that on my iPad today, and if I'm able to do that on the iPad Mini, you know, it's thumbs up for me.
Yeah. I'm very interested to see how it performs in a travel situation as well, because the next few months of my life look like quite a lot of traveling. And over time, I've just kind of progressively taken less and less technology. And if I think back to 10 years ago, what I was carrying on my back when I traveled to the US, 17-inch PowerBook G4, you know, which weighed about 6 pounds, and then the power brick for that thing weighed about a pound in its own. And now, potentially, I could have my little keyboard case and an iPad Mini, and I'm completely functional. That's an incredible reduction.
Well, yeah, I'm actually going to be traveling this weekend to go speak at a conference in Memphis, and I'm going to present and only take my iPad and my iPhone. So I'll be doing the presenting from my iPad. I had to borrow the VGA adapter from a friend of mine. If I didn't know that Lightning was the way of the future, I would have just bought it, but I don't want to buy it because I do presentations somewhat, but I usually do them for my Mac, like internally. And so I'll wait and on my next iPad, get the Lightning port to VGA adapter, and it just makes it a lot easier to travel with. When even a 13-inch laptop, it's just easier to travel with my iPad and my iPhone, and it's easy.
Yeah, I have ordered the Lightning to VGA adapter for my iPad Mini. It's shipping substantially later than the Mini itself. Actually, I should have it before Christmas at this rate, but the VGA to dock connector has been the bane of my life for more than 2 years now, and I think it's fair to say that it was a terrible design. And the main reason being that the plug did not latch into the body of the iPad. And time after time, if I could add up the amount of time that I have spent waiting for people to reconnect their iPad to the projector after accidentally knocking out the VGA cable because they moved their iPad a fraction, I could have another lifetime, because it just happens all the time. And particularly if you have somebody with an ill-fitting case that isn't cut out around the dock connector properly. And I certainly hope that the more positive latch of the Lightning connector will eliminate a lot of that problem as well, which would be very nice, because that's been a real bugbear for us in school.
Do you want to take a quick sponsor break?
Let's do that.
All right. EasyGrade app is back this week, and I'm a little frustrated with Paul Brown, the creator of it. We've been playing Letterpress, and I don't know if you've played that game. It's a new game from Lauren Brichter, the creator of Tweety. So word game, and so I've been playing Paul quite a bit, and he's beaten me every time. So I'm a little frustrated with Paul, but easy grade is great. We've had a bunch of our teachers purchase it, and big news I've got today is he's actually submitted a universal version to Apple, and it's still going to be 99 cents. And so again, what this app is overall is it allows your teachers to ditch the cardboard easy grader. It's the best one in the store. It's super simple to configure. It can do partial credit. You can calculate based on half or whole points. Some other great features, you can adjust the number of questions very easily with a quick tap. You can choose whether you want to calculate the grades based on correct or incorrect answers. You can easily decrease or increase the font size. And again, as I said, for the past 2 weeks, it's already been updated for the iPhone 5 and iOS 6. And that to me is a sign of an active developer. When it's a 99 cent application, he's already taken the time to get it upgraded. A little background on the app is he built it for his wife. His wife is a school teacher. And so, you know, he's got a critic right in his own home that if she doesn't like something, you know, he'll change it. And so he's got his audience right there with him. Again, great application. It'd be a great Christmas present for your teachers just to go in there and buy it through the volume purchase store. Again, Easy Grade app in the App Store. Quickest way to find out about it is easygradeapp.com. Again, 99 cents. Big thanks to Paul for sponsoring the show again this week.
All right. Yeah. Letterpress, the game that crashed Game Center.
It's you know, and I've not won a game yet. That's what's bad. I mean, Paul's beat me, and I've been playing Stephen Hackett at 512 Pixels and a couple other people, and I have just not won a game and quite embarrassed by that.
I had a few tries of Letterpress, but my brain is not wired for anagrams at all. I can't play Scrabble, I can't play Boggle, and I cannot play Letterpress either. So I've had to pass on that.
One final note on Easy Grade is I will put a link to a screenshot of the Universal application in the show notes as well. It's in review, so it should be coming out. It may be out by the time you listen to this show.
Awesome. Yep. Another little bit of Apple news, just I believe last night, actually, as we were recording this, not to be cynical about it, but this news came out just as a hurricane was hitting America. Apple's recent executive shakeup, which surprised a lot of people. Big changes at the top of Apple. Scott Forstall, the senior VP of iOS software, I believe, is leaving the company next year, and John Browett, who was the head of Apple's retail operations, has left the company as well. And there's been a reorganization of the senior vice presidents in charge of various parts of the company. I think of the two people who are leaving the company, one was a very big surprise, and one was really no surprise at all. I think John Browett was previously the head of a company called Dixon Stores Group in the UK, which is known for being a kind of mid to low end electronics retailer, and not, try to pick my words very carefully here, but not a broadly popular place to do business, shall we say. I think it's roughly the equivalent of buying from somewhere like Circuit City, or probably not even quite as good as Best Buy in the US, and certainly not a Fry's type operation. And a lot of people in the UK were very, very surprised when Browett was hired at Apple. And I think it's not particularly surprising that his tenure has not been particularly long. I think the departure of Forstall is much more surprising. There were rumors and there were articles written by Business Week, for example, which said that Forstall was not a particularly easy person to work with at Apple. And I think what you're seeing is kind of the end of a certain power struggle at the top levels of Apple, and Forstall doesn't seem to have won the day there. Do you get any thoughts on that, Bradley?
Well, I think bottom line is I read it from Ohm Malik. He's the guy that created GigaOhm. He said it seems like that Scott forgot that he was Steve's guy and not Steve, And again, you know, since I don't know the inner workings of what went down, but just from what I've read, that, you know, it's Steve was a very unique person, and he managed a very unique way. And we'll all talk about, you know, management lessons from Steve Jobs and things like that. But, you know, you've got to be Steve to act like Steve. And from my perspective, it seems like everything that Eddie Q has got his hands on has gotten better. You know, the iTunes store is technology-wise seems to be a great success, processing a lot of data. I cannot remember the last time you know, the store went down, you couldn't purchase things. The overall experience in the App Store has largely continued to get better, in my opinion. The iBook Store seems to work well. And iCloud works well and is a vast improvement over the product he took over in Mobile Me. And my perspective, and if you ask me what is Apple's weaknesses, it will always be internet services. You know, they seem they can do hardware and software very well, but internet services are where they tend to struggle. And it seems like anytime Eddie Q gets a hold of another service, it gradually gets better. And so I think the fact that he's hanging around is great. Johnny Ive is obviously very important to Apple. And if I had to pick one of the two, I would say in some ways Forstall is the more replaceable one.
Yeah, I agree. I think Ive is such an iconic figure now, not just at Apple, but across the whole computing industry, that for him to leave Apple would have been a very serious matter, I think. You know, people on Twitter have sort of hated on Scott Forstall over the past couple of days, and indeed before he left Apple, because of this whole fuss about so-called skeuomorphic interfaces, by which people mostly mean the sort of very physical leather and paper appearance of certain applications like Find My Friends, iBooks, and Calendar and Addressbook, or Contacts in iOS. And it was kind of known that Forstall was very much in favor of that style of design, and Johnny Ive was very much against that style of design. But I think it's important not to overlook what Forstall achieved at Apple, because, you know, we talk a lot about iOS on this show, and I think, if nothing else, Forstall deserves to go down in history as the guy who was absolutely on the right side of the very early decision that iOS should be a genetic inheritor of OS X. Because in the early days of the iPhone project, there was a real battle going on inside Apple about whether the phone should be based on the Pixel embedded operating system that powered the iPod, or whether it should be a descendant of OS X. And Forstall was very much on the OS X side of that house, and he was absolutely right to be there. And I think his contribution should not be reduced to he was the guy who liked stitched leather, because he was actually did a lot for Apple over his time in charge. And of course, has taken iOS from a nascent project all the way up to Apple's platform for the future. And I think he deserves a lot of respect for that.
I 100% agree. It would be a tough job. And I do, you know, I'm trying to think, what would I love Scott Forstall to do now? And in some ways, I would love to see him go and start a company that makes apps, and to see what they could do, because you know he could attract some talent to come work for him. But no, I agree. You know, it was a surprise in one instance, but on the other hand, you've heard rumblings for months, and so maybe it shouldn't be as a surprise. But I think it's really important to realize this is a big decision for Tim. And I think it's important for Tim to make these kind of decisions and to show himself as a strong leader to make tough decisions.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is very much taking on the shape of Tim Cook's Apple. And it was important for people to see him make big decisions like this. And I think the other change that I think is important to the line of work we're in is that iOS and OS X are coming together in one team at Apple. Craig Federighi, who was in charge of OS X and did a great job, in my opinion, of delivering Mountain Lion, is now going to lead both iOS and OS X. And I think that's a very interesting move in itself, because I think what that will hopefully do is it will open up collaboration. I mean, the whole heading of the press release was Apple makes changes to enhance collaboration across the company. I hope it will certainly be very interesting to see how the relatively different cultures of the OS X department inside Apple and the iOS department come together, and whether it becomes a little bit more open like the OS X or a little bit more closed like iOS, not sure. But Craig Federighi was certainly on the OS X side of the house before, and he's now bringing iOS under his wing as well. And what that will mean for the future of the platforms that we deliver every day is going to be a very interesting thing to keep our eyes on.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, so let's move on. We're taking our sweet time here. This could be a long show.
You want to go ahead and do the second sponsor break?
Let's do that.
You know, it's funny. There are two applications that make me want to be a student again. Keynote, I grew up with PowerPoint when I was in high school and college, and to be able to actually do presentations in school with Keynote would be wonderful. But the second one is this new sponsor. It's Timeline 3D for iOS from a company called Beedocs. Beedocs, just like it sounds. Beedocs Timeline 3D for iOS. Now they have a Mac application, but this is for the iOS, for the iPhone, the iPod Touch, and the iPad. And it's a tool for teachers and students to create and present timelines that they can show on those iOS devices. Or, to me, this is where the magic happens. You can actually mirror it to the Apple TV. So what class would this be great in? In my opinion, it would be a killer application for history classes. And the notes they sent me is they had a classroom of students in France who they worked together to build a multimedia timeline of major events in World War II. And the students included images and video clips in which they'd found in the research, and then they added narrations on top of those. This app is incredibly easy to use. And again, even if you don't deploy it classroom-wide, if you have an Apple TV, it's worth just trying the AirPlay. It just makes me want to go to a history class and have a project just to be able to use this application. Timelines begin as a standard 2D chart, and then you can shift to 3D with a tap of a button. It has a flyover effect that brings in the visual focus to, like, you know, the individual events, but they also showing them in relations to the other events. It's currently coming soon. It should be out in the next week or two. Just talked to the guys today. They have submitted it to Apple. Do not expect any issues getting it approved. It's only $14.99, and it is also available through the volume purchase program. So if you're a history teacher and want to do a cool project for your students, this would be a great way to spend some of your app money. I played with the demo, and I cannot get over how awesome it is. Within a few minutes of downloading it, I'd built a simple chart or a simple timeline, AirPlayed it to my Apple TV, and my mind was absolutely blown. We'll have a link in the show notes to their website. You can check out some of their other work. And I also put out a tweet from my account when it's actually in the App Store. But again, that's Beedocs Timeline 3D. It's at beedocs.com, and I'll put an app in the show notes.
Okay, and there is a Mac app version of that. I don't know if you mentioned that there. I think there is a Mac version.
Yes,
right?
There is a Mac version as
so
well.
So people could get a feel for what that app is like, even if before it comes out in the store as well.
Yeah, I can't say enough great things about it. I'm jealous of a student that gets to do a presentation with this app.
Cool. Okay, so in place of our scheduled guest this week, we're going to catch up in our postbag, which is thank you everybody for so much feedback, which has been so incredibly positive, and questions, a lot of questions, a lot of comments as well. And what we've done is I've gone through the postbag and I've pulled out what I think are the kind of big questions that I wanted to follow up on in the show. And we're just going to run through those just now. So first question from Rob Coote is, are we going to have any kind of interactive shows? Is there any way for listeners to get involved with richer feedback to the show? And the answer is not yet, but we are looking into ways to do that. And one of the things we're thinking about doing is trying to use Google Plus Hangouts on air as a way to do a kind of live streaming show. We haven't yet tested the technology for that, to record the show and do it on Google Hangout at the same time. Having done a couple of Google Hangouts, I know the impact that it has on the fan on my computer. So I don't know if that will negatively impact the audio, but we're going to test that and we're going to see what we can do with that, we'll maybe do maybe one a month that's live or something. So keep your ears posted for that. Next question, Ryan Williamson asks about adopting a learning management system as well as iTunes U. He's involved in an iPad trial, and there have been a lot of discussions as to which LMS should be adopted. They have Blackboard, but not particularly happy with it, and teachers have been encouraged to experiment with the hope of standardizing in the near future. Some of them are looking at Edmodo, others using Haiku, Course Sites, and various others. And Ryan's asking about where iTunes U fits into all of that. And his concern is that iTunes U is very much a one-way channel. And I agree with him. I think that iTunes U is a fantastic content distribution system, but it essentially does nothing for the inbound half of that, the inbound half of the problem of document workflow between teachers and students. So Edmodo seems to get a lot of good press. Have you used Edmodo, Bradley?
I have not. We've had some teachers inquiring about it, so I've got it on my to-do list to look at it, but I've heard great things about it.
Yeah, I have too. I have some contacts in Australia who I know are very, very keen on Edmodo. Edmodo is a kind of, it's most often described as a kind of Facebook-like system for education. So it's not strictly a document submission system either, but it facilitates kind of classroom interaction. We've also, at Cedars, we've just used email as a way to do the document submission part of that. But I'm very aware that that doesn't scale up to, you know, a high school teacher who's seeing 200 pupils a week or whatever. And there are larger systems that are required for that. I think the broader answer to that question is, with the current state of play on iOS, what you're really looking for is you're looking for some kind of system that supports submission by email attachment. And I don't know of any really good ones right now. There's one that I have a friend in California, Don Orth, who really likes a system called eBackpack, which provides a lot of that. It provides a web dev interface, and I believe it also does support email upload in recent versions as well. So I think it's potentially, it could be confusing if you end up with too many of these systems, but I think Ryan's group are taking the right approach to let teachers experiment and then try and standardize, rather than trying to guess ahead of time what it is that you're looking for. And I think the trick there is going to be to identify what are the pain points that you're trying to take away, and then find a system that takes away those pain points. So the question that Ryan poses there is a little conflicted, because on one hand, the question is, what do we use for student collaboration? And then what do we use for document submission for grading? And the answer to those two things may not actually be the same. And maybe a WordPress blog or something is the best thing just to communicate. And then with comments on the blog, or maybe a wiki or something, but then there's maybe some other system based on email and filtering for document submission. So iTunes U does a certain job of work, but it certainly does not do everything. And I wouldn't necessarily recommend, if you really, really need a system for handling submissions from 200 pupils a week, then iTunes U really isn't going to do a lot for you, and you may be better off looking for something with more power on the inbound side of it, and maybe have to compromise a little bit on the slickness of the outbound side just to get that power on the back end.
No, I agree. And I think this market is growing. I think, you know, we had products matured for the web days, and now you're having to see products kind of reinvent themselves for the iOS days or the app days. Yeah. And so I think it's one of those things, we may be another 12 to 24 months out to see who emerges as the winner here. You know, one of the trends, it was interesting. I was at a conference this past, or 2 weekends ago, called the Southern Association of Independent Schools. And the neat trend that I'm seeing is school management systems are getting into website development. And then website development companies that are built around schools are getting into school management. So they're trying to integrate those all in. And I could almost see, you know, a company emerging with the whole piece of the pie. They do your front end website, they do your back end school management, they do your, you know, and your learning management system. So it's all, it's one login, it's everything. And I could really see that becoming a new trend.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think so too. And some of these ones that we've mentioned, obviously iTunes U, but also Edmodo. And there's another one that I've looked at before called Piazza, which is used by Stanford in their in-session iTunes U courses. They also have actual apps as well. So I certainly lean towards people who are trying to do an app, but as long as those apps are quite good, and I believe the Edmodo one is really quite good. The Piazza one was clearly early days when I looked at it, and it didn't have all the functionality in the app that it had on the website, but it's definitely coming along as well. So I would hesitate to adopt an LMS and iTunes U together. I would try and find one thing, and maybe you find that one thing by experimentation, but I think I would lean towards one thing rather than two if you can avoid it. Okay, next question or feedback is about ebooks and social reading. It comes from Gregor McNish, and his first comment is that he's working at a technical college and has been suggesting that teachers have students submit assessments in EPUB format as a nice way of combining media with annotations and reflection, which I think is a really interesting idea. We've seen a lot of enthusiasm for teachers to use creating ebooks as a way of assessment. We started doing this about a year ago with an app called Book Creator for iPad, which has become very, very popular. There's another one called Creative Book Builder, which I'm not personally so keen on, but I know a lot of people do like it. And we've done things with that where you can have pupils build up a book with audio and video and so on, as well as just writing and pictures. And that's been pretty powerful. Gregor asks about, do we have any thoughts on social reading? There's been a bit of a start with Kindle in sharing notes and highlights, and an app called Open Margin takes a regular EPUB and turns it into a forum so you can see what other people are thinking as they read. Doesn't seem to be actively developed, unfortunately, so it's a bit rough. I think social reading kind of falls into the same category of complaints that we normally have about electronic books, is that nobody's quite moving fast enough on these things. I don't know. Are you a Kindle user, Bradley?
I use the Kindle app on my iPad, but I've never actually owned a Kindle device.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the idea of the social reading. You know, imagine, I just kind of thought of this, imagine a math textbook, a digital math textbook, where you could highlight, where every class was somehow linked together, all the students in the class are linked together. And if you could kind of highlight, you know, question five, or if the teacher comes in the next day and says, wow, every kid seemed to have questions on question five, I know I need to delve in that further. It's kind of like, instead of the teacher having to say, okay, where do we struggle at? She mm-hmm. knows, you know, the night before where her kids are struggling. They're struggling with question five. Maybe, yeah. Maybe if she, for whatever reason, is on her computer late at night, or not late at night, but, you know, 7-8 o'clock at night, sees a lot of her parents are having questions about question five, or students are struggling with question five. Maybe she sends out a quick blast and says, hey, I'm going to start a WebEx, and I'm going to walk you guys through this again. Mm-hmm. Just so it's kind of like the immediate feedback, I guess.
Yeah, and it also kind of reaches in a little bit to learning analytics, where you could potentially gather information about what people are looking at, how long they're spending, and so on. There is another app called Inkling, which attempted to do some of this stuff as well, where you could have shared marginalia, if you like, in electronic books, and that seemed to be quite interesting. But I haven't looked too much at Inkling, because they were really attacking the US university market rather than K-12, and certainly not internationally too much either. But they had some interesting technology in there as well. So again, very early days for a lot of that stuff, and I guess we'll see where it goes. But I think it is something that's potentially, you know, very interesting and powerful. Gregor also just asked at the end about interested in hearing our thoughts about Dropbox in schools for personal use and collaboration. It seems so much more useful than the siloed iCloud and is supported by many apps. I critically depend on Dropbox. What can I say? We have not used it very much for pupil use. We've used it a little bit for teachers This is before we got iTunes U to distribute large files. But that was one of those things where we were having individual teachers experiment with different systems. And in fact, we replaced that mode of use of Dropbox with iTunes U in our case. But I know that teachers between ourselves, because we are all working with a laptop and iOS devices, that for the stuff that we do on the laptops, we are using Dropbox pretty extensively to collaborate.
And I think, you know, we use it internally. We don't have a Dropbox for Teams account that is incredibly expensive, but we use it for various solutions. I know, like, I publish on our website what's called classroom overviews and our notes home. We don't send paper home in terms of like a newsletter every week. It's all posted online. Well, the school secretary, she puts all that together in a Word document, and we just have a shared Dropbox folder. And she tells me they're done. They're already on my computer. I copy them, post them online. So we're doing it on a lot of those solutions. And I think you'll find, especially as your teachers get more savvy, they kind of look at these solutions. And a perfect mm-hmm. example of, you know, how I feel like teachers are kind of becoming their own enablers and their own integrators is we have our facilities manager here just had a new camera and a new camera system installed on the inside and outside of the building. Well, they gave it network access, so they got a public IP address for me, and we mapped it internally to give it, you know, access from an off network. Well, I saw him the other day, and he showed me an iPhone app he had found that would allow his camera system to be seen from iOS. He didn't need my help for that. He found it. He bought it. It asked for the IP address and his username and password. He plugged that all in, and he was good to go. And I look at Dropbox like a solution like that is you give people the tools. Like you give people – I gave him the IP address, and he found a cool solution to take it even further. And maybe you explain Dropbox to your teachers, and they come up with awesome solutions on how they're going to use it.
Yeah. I think the sort of subtext of Gregor's question is why iCloud when you have Dropbox? And I think the two things are fundamentally different. They're actually philosophically different. They're not just different technologies. And if you think about what iCloud provides, there's a reason that the document syncing system in iCloud is called Documents in the Cloud and not Files in the Cloud. Because if you think about it, what Dropbox is, it's a folder in the file system that syncs. And it's wonderfully simple and reliable because that's what it is. Whereas what iCloud is doing, it says your documents everywhere. And those are not, they're fundamentally not the same thing. iOS, as we all know, goes to great lengths to abstract the file system away from the user. Whereas Dropbox absolutely depends on the visibility of the file system. And the problem for a school like mine, which is primarily iOS, is that there are very few, in fact, there are essentially no, well, that's not true. There are, but it's app dependent. There's no OS level round tripping system between Dropbox and iOS apps. Now that you've got the Dropbox app on iOS, you can open a file from your Dropbox in an application, but what's happening there is you're taking a copy from Dropbox, you're copying it into the application sandbox, you're editing it, and then if you're lucky, copying it back to Dropbox using OpenIn, which is the standard method in iOS of moving files around, which I may also say is the most antiquated part of iOS, and Android makes it look like a baby toy by comparison to what you can do in Android for that. But the point being that if you open a file from Dropbox in an application that doesn't then allow you to open that file back into Dropbox, then you're stuck. And that's where we've been stuck for 2 years with iWork, is that iWork, you could open a file from Dropbox in an iWork application in iOS, but you could not then get that file back out of your iWork sandbox into your Dropbox. Now, the very latest update of iWork, which came out with iOS 6, added that feature. So you can now open an iWork file back into the Dropbox application to upload it. But then again, you're still leaving a trail of an edited version in your iWork and then another version in Dropbox. So it's just not as clean a round-tripping experience on iOS as it is on any desktop class platform that exposes the file system. But that's them's the breaks, right? That's the natural outcome of iOS's move to abstract the file system, is that you have to find other ways to do those things. And iCloud, yes, one of its big failings right now is that you can't collaborate between two people using iOS's cloud syncing system. But I'm not convinced that that will always be true.
Well, I think, you know, shared photo streams to me may be the first step towards that, you know, shared iCloud documents.
Yeah. Yeah, shared photo streams is a nice idea that needs really fleshed out. And the biggest disappointment I had with that was that I couldn't create a photo stream that two people could put photos into. Because what I wanted to do is between myself and my wife, just have a shared photo stream for all the pictures we take of the kids. But what happened was that I shared with her, and then she shared with me, and we ended up with two photo streams, one with all my pictures and one with all her pictures, which, you know, is not exactly what we were looking for. And I think in a classroom situation, if you had one photo stream that the entire class could post into, that starts to open up some very exciting possibilities in the future. So, Craig Federighi, build that for me, please. Thank you. Okay, next question is from Dan Keeling. Thank you, Dan, for providing a pronunciation for your name. He asks about bring your own device and gap provision. And he says that one other issue that you may have not considered when looking at the various drawbacks of bring your own device is that in public schools, in the US at least, there are some students who don't have the ability to pay for any device at all and indeed can't be required to. This is certainly also true in the UK and I'm pretty sure everywhere. In many US states, schools districts are required to waive some or all of the fees based on the student's household income level, also very common in the UK and also true for independent schools in the UK as well. There's something called the public benefit test that gives us the right to be considered a charity. And one of the things we have to do there is we have to provide methods for pupils who cannot typically afford to come to an independent school to be able to do that. So, yeah, that's a common scenario for us too. Dan continues, there are students who can't afford a $100 device, much less a $500 one. So then you have to provide these students some device. For that pool of students, the entire cost benefit of bring your own device goes up in smoke. And then not only do you have inequality between students' devices, you have inequality between student devices and what the school provides. And I think right there in a nutshell is pretty much one of my biggest issues with bring your own device is the sort of equality argument of it as well. I was looking at some numbers recently about how many computers we would have to buy in Scotland in order to provide one-to-one. And it struck me that if even 30% of pupils, say in Glasgow, for example, couldn't afford a device, then Glasgow would have to increase by 50% the number of computers they've got just to cover the gap, never mind to provide everybody with one. And I think in some ways, BYOD sort of purports to give you all the benefits of one-to-one without all the costs of one-to-one. But even if you commit to only covering the gap for people who have got income problems, sometimes you can end up actually blowing your budget massively. You may even have to double your budget just to cover the gap, depending on the sort of income status of your area. So that's one that can come along and bite you right at the end if you don't think about it. And I think it's a good point from Dan as well, that even just covering the gap may end up being quite expensive and more than you necessarily bargained for as well. Okay, a few simpler, shorter things. Jim Head asks, can I use Configurator to mass install various PDF files that students can use in iBooks? We're going to use supervised mode where students can install their own stuff on top of what we install with Configurator. Answer, I believe, is yes to that.
Yeah, I think he meant to say...
You know more than I do about Configurator.
I think he meant to say we're going to use unsupervised mode, I think is right. What he meant there. Now, I got a lot of questions about this on Twitter as well. Like, hey, you know, how do we get this app out or in? The key with Apple Configurator is if the app can use iTunes file sharing, you can install files in there. So that's really this. It's the simplest way to do it. So iBooks, you should be no problem. Now, I will say here's an example of where you could have some workflow issues. The app that we use to review our spelling in some of our grades is called Spellboard. And the way I share, I create the lessons on my iPad and I share them to all the other ones. I just use email because it's just simplest for me. I have a generic email account tied to all the devices and I just use the open end. And that may be a long-term solution for you is if these are, well, not in that situation because these are going to be unsupervised. But if these were supervised, you could have a generic email account and that could be the way you could quickly get files on there. But I know that that app does support iTunes file sharing, but it doesn't immediately load the file in there. You have to go and import it and say import from iTunes. You know, even though it's, you know, not still not tethered to iTunes, it's like it puts the file in some sort of holding area from the best I can tell. And there may have been an update to fix that from last time I checked. But that's just the only thing to caveat is experiment on the applications and see what your students are going to see when they open the app.
Yeah, I think when I see a question like this, my first question back is, what exactly is it you're trying to do here? Because is it are these course materials? Because in Jim's email, he actually also said that they were going to use iTunes U as well. So if these are course material PDFs, I would certainly encourage him to think about putting those in your iTunes U course. If these are school handbook type materials, maybe the best thing to do is to put some of those on a website where people can get them if they need them. I think it's very, the question, the meta question, if you like, is really what are these files and under what circumstances would somebody need to have access to them? And there may be ways in which you can do that in a more space efficient way as well, because if these end up being big files, you may want to give people opportunity to download it and then erase it and then download it again, and iTunes U is a great way to do that. Okay, next question. Kev Rogers asks about Wi-Fi bottlenecks. He says, a class of about 15 students all tried to download a bunch of apps from the App Store and encountered serious slowness. It'd be interesting hearing your thoughts about network performance when several students try to download apps at the same time.
I actually, Kev Rogers and I spoke offline about this, and you know, my question, you know, these wireless questions are hard to answer based on just the initial question. You kind of got to gather some information. Okay, what vendor are you using? How many access points are you using? You know, how are your settings? And I believe he was using a Cisco deployment. And, you know, I kind of gave him some advice on some things to check out. And I know he ended up working with his vendor and they tweaked the network and it's drastically improved. And that's mm-hmm. the thing to remember about wireless is, there are tweaks that can be made. You know, I know like in our Aerohop system, they have a load balancing setting, but we don't use that on the majority of our access points because I've basically got one access point per classroom. So I want the students in that classroom connecting to the one that's closest to them. I don't want them to be, you know, roamed to one that may be a little farther away that mm-hmm. maybe has fewer clients on it, but they'll have a slower connection. I want them to be on the one that's closest. And so that's where you really just want to work with your vendor, study your vendor and see see what they have. And you know, 'cause there is no silver bullet, I guess, answer on wireless issues. You've got to kind of delve in there and see what's going on. Look at your troubleshooting tools. I know the tool that I use with Aerohive, if I ever have issues, is their client monitor. And so I can go in there and put a client monitor on a certain MAC address and see what it does. You know, I can mm-hmm. see when it roams from access point to access point, see and see exactly what the error messages are. And that's how you kind of delve in there. And again, this is, you know, Andrew and I talked about that wireless is hard, and this is why it's hard. Because if you have a slowdown on wired Ethernet, it typically is a little easier to try to diagnose. With wireless, it could be that someone turned on an X10 camera, and that's what shut the whole network down.
Yep. Yeah, that's definitely, I mean, that's the classic issue with Wi-Fi is you've got to know a lot about the environment, and you've got to know a lot about the deployment itself to answer those in issues. I think referring back to the last show, I think is also a good place to start. Andrew, you and Andrew talked about designing for both signal coverage and density. And this was something that I certainly experienced in my first Wi-Fi deployment at Cedars was, these base stations only handle 10 clients and we've got 12, you know. And that was the kind of scale we were working with back in 2008. But Yeah, it's definitely, and I think this also brings back the kind of thing that we've advocated before, that using these more expensive but also more powerful Wi-Fi networks rather than consumer-grade equipment gives you the information to solve these problems. Because this is the kind of scenario I was in 6 months ago when we were with Airport Extreme. They were perfectly reliable base stations, except that when there was an issue like this, I had no insight into what was going on in order to actually start to diagnose those problems. And to my mind, nowadays, with the fact that Wi-Fi is so critical to the whole mission in schools, you've got to have insight into that information. So, next question, and I have a very short and good answer to this one, is how important is Apple TV and AirPlay, from Paul Brown? He says, we've been able to show the iPad screen on a VGA projector for years just using the dock connector. I've already complained about that device in this show. Yes, you're tethered, which can be a bad thing, but in a pinch, you'd save some money and in some way simplify things. And that is certainly true. There is a very strong case for simplification with a direct cable. One of the biggest problems I had with the VGA adapter, apart from it falling out the iPad all the time, which was horrible, was also that teachers had a habit of losing them as well. And those things are not cheap. And I think, you know, I just paid £40 for a Lightning to VGA adapter, and I could pay £80 and get an Apple TV, or 94, whatever it is. So an Apple TV is only just fractionally more expensive than two VGA adapters. And you lose one, you replace it with another one, you've just spent about as much as an Apple TV. So I think that in situations where you're not moving your equipment about a lot, I'm really a big fan of Apple TV, partly because, you know, nobody will typically come in and steal the Apple TV out of your classroom, but it has been my experience, as much as I love all my colleagues, that once or twice they might, in a pinch, have borrowed my VGA adapter, and that doesn't always make for a harmonious school. Okay, this is more of a pointer for some future show, but Chris Kimpton asks, any plans to cover various programming and education type programs such as Code Club, Coder Dojo, and volunteering? He says his interest is in what's the most effective. I can see that long-term courses would help more than quick-hit one-day events, and that primary school sessions to get them while they're young also seem to make sense. A lot of interesting moves on that right now. Raspberry Pi is an interesting device as well. I've done some things recently using Amazon EC2 and programming on iPads, and I think what we'll do is we'll maybe organize ourselves to spend a bit more time on that in a future show. But yeah, there's a lot to talk about there.
Yeah, I think that's a great thing, is the more kids we can get to at least dabble in programming. You know, again, we teach kids math, and not all of them use math, you know, in their jobs day to day. When they get older, but if we can at least expose them, they can have at least an understanding of what's going on.
Yeah. I think I've spoken about this extensively when I present. My only fear about the kind of current enthusiasm for coding in schools is that in a world where you don't have very many computers in schools, and that's the world that we're in the UK, I don't want it to become a situation where you have to be taking a programming class in order to get time on computers. And that was certainly the situation that we were in my school pre-iPad a few years back, was that unless you were in my classroom taking my computing course, there wasn't much time left in the schedule for anybody else to get access to computers for any other purpose. And I think I would be very wary of any situation where you had to be taking programming in order to get access to the computers. And that may be a strawman argument. I'm not saying I'm necessarily right on that, and I'm not saying that's what people who are into teaching coding in schools are advocating for, but it may be one of the unintended consequences when you're constrained for devices in schools and you want to have a big coding program, is that all of those computers have to go to the coding program, and suddenly you can't get one if you're a history student, for example. Ian Stoba asks a very short question. Have we had any issues with devices being lost or stolen? What precautions have you taken or would you recommend to help protect the devices? We have never had a device lost or stolen. We've had broken ones, yes. One boy, unfortunately, had his hidden under the Christmas tree by some other boys in the school. So that took us an afternoon to find that with some threats of various sanctions. I think one of the best things you could do is our biggest problem has been people mislaying their device in the school building rather than people leaving it on the bus or whatever. And I think one of the big arguments in favour of having an individualised Apple ID set up is that you could turn on, have everybody turn on Find My iPad, and then you can just make the device ping in the school, and that can be very helpful. You know, just put up a message that says, please return me to the office. I have been lost is very useful. Yes, we carry spares, but I think we've talked to this before, Bradley, that we're kind of recommending a spare ratio of between 1% and 2% for that kind of thing. Unless you're in a very... Well, I want to roll back on that. I was going to say unless you're in a very high crime area, but I am in a very high crime area, and we haven't had that many problems with it so far, touch wood.
Well, and this goes back to our lease discussion as well. If you're leasing these devices, your leasing company may require insurance, and so that would be a good place to start. And I think it's important to, you know, we've not had any issues, and I think it's important to not go overkill. And it's perfectly an acceptable solution if, you know, you just, if you can get, if you can, you know, run to the Apple store and buy one on drop of a hat, it's perfectly acceptable to use that as your backup.
Absolutely. Yep. Lightweight stuff. And also as just in time as you can make it. And that's all very dependent on how quickly you can get that stuff. But I've heard of people who've spoken to me and they've suggested that they're thinking about deploying LTE iPads and putting data connections on them, and the prime motivation for doing that was so that if a device got stolen, they could track it wherever it went, and that is just way too much. You know, you add up what you're going to spend for a data connection and the 3G circuitry when you wouldn't otherwise put it in, you've just bought yourself like 50 spares. You
know? Exactly.
It's really important. I agree with you. Really important not to go overboard and what could happen there. Okay. We're running down to the last couple of questions here. This has been quite a long show, but I think quite a useful one. Jacob Dubois refers to a speech by the superintendent of the LA Unified School District, the second largest district in the US, who announced that he wants to put a tablet device in every teacher and student's hand within the next 15 months. And we'll have a link to that article in the show notes as well. They're saying tablet, obviously, and they're, I'm sure, going to weigh options. But Jacob asks, how would you convince them that an Apple tablet is the way to go on such a large scale? So just a little bit of background in the story. He says in his annual address to administrators before the academic year, he said that he wanted LAUSD to prepare the students, 650,000 plus students, for the future. He says, I'm committed to working with this Board of Education to find a way to put a tablet in the hands of every student and school staff member in the next 15 months. Interesting point of scale here. If LAUSD is 650,000 students, the whole of Scotland is 670,000 students. So we have 32 different districts, 32 different systems in Scotland to do that, and they've got one. So that's an interesting point of comparison there. How would you convince him, Bradley? I'm just thinking that's a big, big program.
It is. It's a big overarching question. And I would say look for the company that can provide you the resources you need. You know, which company is in it for the long haul? Is it, you know, your cheap Android tablet from Walgreens? Is it, and that's why, again, people ask me, you know, why don't you just deploy the Kindle Fires? Why don't you just deploy a Nexus 7? Well, it's because Apple gives us the complete package in terms of, you know, purchasing and management and deployment. Again, I would love some additional things from them, but they're giving us more than the rest of the guys. I talked over email to a listener that did an Android deployment as a trial, and he was having to set up each device individually. And there was no, volume purchasing program that he could find, and that's a problem. He said, you know, we require a purchase order for every single purchase. Well, Apple can do that. They can, you know, that's one of the things, the volume purchase program, you can buy those vouchers with a purchase order.
Yep. I think, to be honest with you, that was one of the motivating factors behind when I chose iPad. I mean, at the time, there wasn't a huge amount of choice. It was basically iPad or the Dell Streak, which was an Android tablet that Dell made, which even saying those words now seems a bit weird. But it was clear to me even then that Apple were really behind the iPad. And if Dell stopped making their Android tablet tomorrow, it wouldn't even be a footnote in the history of that company. And I think history has proven that I was right about that. So I agree. I think doing a deployment at that kind of scale, I think you have to lean fairly heavily on the idea that a lot of people already know how to do this, right? And out of 650,000 students, how many of them already know iOS and indeed act in a systems administrator capacity for their own personal devices already? And I think... if you look at iOS, one of the things you have to think about doing is, can you decentralize the management of these devices? And one of the ways you can do that with iOS is that it is so simple to do. Whereas, say, if you were going for a Windows 8 thing, there would still be both the opportunity and probably the tendency to try and do a centralized deployment of that scale. And I think you would probably run into some interesting issues with that. So I agree with you. I think that Apple's clearly playing a big game with this. Amazon are playing a big game as well, but they're playing a very different game. They're trying to sell you... I don't want to be cynical about this because I think the Kindle Fire is quite a nice device, but everything in the Kindle Fire is designed to be a vending machine for Amazon content. And I think, yes, Apple have their store, but we know where Apple's money comes from is actually selling you the device. And we know that Amazon's money comes from essentially giving you the device at cost and then having you buy content after the fact. And I think there's interesting balance there as well. And again, with Google as well, if they are, they're basically selling the Nexus 7 at cost. Over the long term and betting on that platform, can you be totally confident about that? I mean, yes, Google has got a lot of runway before they have to give up on any program. Same as Microsoft with the Xbox when they started as well. They're so rich they can keep that going for a long time. But when you're trying to talk about culture change in that scale, you got to look for something that is sustainable over the very long term. And that really, to finish that point, I think that the culture change is actually the hardest part. It's not actually whatever device you choose. It's getting 650,000 students plus probably something like 50,000 to 60,000 teachers to all buy in and use that. And in many ways, the technology is actually the easy part. The hard part is getting everybody to agree that this is what we're going to do. And I have no experience of doing something at that scale. So I would love to be I'd love to be involved in that project. I'd love to be a fly on the wall for somebody else to be involved in that project and just see exactly how it goes.
Yeah, you've got to make the decisions. You've got to make the right decisions in the beginning with that size.
Yeah. And I think take your time to get it right as well. You know, you do, when you're in that situation, you have to look at absolutely everything. And in some ways, I'm not a crazy fan of Chromebooks, but I think one of the big advantages that Chromebooks have is that they just kind of incrementally get better in the background. You know, they don't have the same sort of deployment techniques as you would have with even iOS. Simple as iOS is, there are certainly some things that you have to do with it that Chromebooks seem to just kind of take away from you in the back end. And I think that's quite an impressive and quite a compelling argument as well. Okay, last question. We're running, this is probably going to be the longest show ever, but let's keep going. TJ Looma, our friend from Twitter, asks several questions, mostly related to the network situation that he has to live with, which I don't know if I've ever felt quite so sorry for anybody in my life, but TJ lives, I believe, in the Midwest, and he has a satellite internet connection, which is A, expensive, B, heavily capped, and C, not very reliable. And his question is there any way to broadcast a message to all iOS devices currently on a local Wi-Fi network? I'm thinking somewhere along the lines of the router will be rebooted in 5 minutes and the network will be offline for 10 after that, or something like that. I don't know if you've used this app, Bradley, but Boxcar seems to be quite a good option for that. I don't know any way to just send a broadcast notification to all devices that happen to be on this network. So you'd have to do a little bit of setup ahead of time for people to be receiving those notifications. But Boxcar seems pretty malleable.
Another one is you could do a combination with an app I've used called Pushover, then plus that if this, then that. I'd have to play with a recipe with that application to see. But there's nothing inherently built in to a Mac server or the iPad management to be able to do that. It would be great to be able to do it, especially even locally. That way, if the internet was down, it could still work over the local LAN.
That would be very nice, yeah. The push notification stuff all depends on having a route to the Apple notification server. And if that goes down, then you're basically not going to get anything. Nothing very good for that, and certainly nothing that can just, on an ad hoc basis, send to every device on this network right now, which is something that would be quite nice to be able to do. He also asks, secondly, is there a way to discover, either programmatically or automatically, all the iOS devices currently on your network? And then, is there any OS X app or various that can track bandwidth usage on the local network? I think for the first of those two parts, it's not super easy. I know that on AeroHive, for example, through your Hive manager, you can look at, it will actually detect the platform that's running on the device. So we can look at our network and say, well, show me all the clients and then filter by OS. That'll work, but obviously an AeroHive deployment is not something you typically have in your house. And obviously an AeroHive system or similar managed Wi-Fi can track the amount of bandwidth going through the network as well. excuse me. And that's also been quite interesting to look at which pupils and indeed teachers may be using more than their fair share of bandwidth as well. I don't know. Have you ever done anything with SNMP on Airport Extreme?
I have not.
Yeah, neither have I.
It's a tough problem, and it really shows that this is something that's, these kind of usage needs are one of the reasons that enterprise Wi-Fi solutions are so great. It's a tough problem.
And that, I think those kind of questions are ones that are one step beyond the kind of features that most consumer grade equipment would deliver you, unfortunately. And his last question, and this is the last question of the show, and I think this probably ends up being a bigger question than for now, but he says, do you do any sort of internet filtering for school networks? I can't imagine a school here in the US not running some kind of filtering, but of course it's all fraught with peril and never going to stop everything anyway. I think we've discussed that a little bit before. OpenDNS, we're big fans. I've recently been experimenting with the iOS 6 global proxy settings and looking at running some filtering somewhere in the cloud for this. One of the things that I came up with was, if you go onto Amazon EC2, which I love, there are a number of pre-built Amazon machine images that you can get. And one of them is provided by Sophos, who have a product called UTM9, which is Universal Threat Management, I think is what the acronym stands for. And part of that is web filtering. So what you can do is you can fire up an Amazon EC2 instance, which is running Sophos UTM-9, and then you can, by configuration, point all your devices to that filtering hub in the cloud. And the beauty of that over something like OpenDNS is that when the device goes off your network, it's still talking to the same filtering hub. So when the device goes home or goes on 3G, if you're going on 3G, you can still provide some kind of filtering for it as well. My problem with Sophos and its like is that nobody puts their prices on their website, so I'm terrified to even ask how much it's going to cost.
Yeah, and we are using OpenDNS here, and then SonicWall, which is owned by Dell, they have a content filtering services. We're running both of them concurrently. Seems to work well for us. Now, I have been hearing rumblings that OpenDNS is launching a product next month called Umbrella, which is supposed to be for the mobile world. So I don't know if it's a similar thing with proxy settings and things like that. I don't know. I guess that's something to keep your eye on, but it's supposed to be called Umbrella.
Yeah, we're both interested in that, I think. I'm keenly aware that we could do more for devices going off the network. Obviously, not for us until we get onto newer devices and get iOS 6, but I think that looks like a good opportunity to just provide a little more due diligence. And now that we can do some of these things in the cloud as opposed to having to do it on our network as well, that's potentially very interesting. Of course, as we know, it's another one of these things that's not, it's important not to go absolutely overboard on, and many kids are carrying a smartphone anyway, so you want to always have a broader conversation about e-safety than just, we're going to lock you down and therefore I've done my job. You've got to think about teaching children and building a culture of safety as well as just providing actual interlocks to prevent certain things happening as well.
I agree.
Okay, so it has been, we've just set a new record for the show. I certainly hope this isn't going to be our standard because there are enough two-hour podcasts in the world already. But yeah, next week we're going to talk iPad Mini in a lot of detail. I shall have one in my hand if all the deliveries go to schedule. And then hopefully the week after that we'll be able to reschedule our Evernote show with our special guest.
Yeah, again, thanks to our sponsors, EasyGrade App at EasyGradeApp.com, and then the BDOX Timeline 3D, which is in review with Apple, or not in review, but it's been submitted to Apple, and you can look at their Mac app at BDOX.com. Again, EasyGrade App is 99 cents in the App Store. Universal App is has been submitted. Then BDOX is a $14.99 U.S. dollar app, which is for iPad, iPhone, and iPod touches.
Okay, so I'm on the web at spears.org. There's a link in show notes as well to my blog post about my thoughts on iPad Mini. I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter, FS on app.net, although kind of lurking there at the moment. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks, guys. Have a great day.